Jim Shoemaker, Steve Anderson, Drew Johnson, and Scott Jordan are registered representatives and investment advisor representatives of Securian Financial Services, Inc., securities dealer, member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor. Shoemaker Financial is independently owned and operated.
Helping you make the most of your money, it's time for Talk Money. Now, your host, Jim Shoemaker.
Whether you're a baby boomer or a millennial, it doesn't seem to matter. A common concern is always money. Well, welcome to today's program. We got a program lined up with you. Got a lot of people. I mean, we just got some things that we're going to be talking about. We're going to answer your questions. Today, we have two questions. First question, we're going to dive in with Scott Jordan in just a second. But it's from the San Francisco Bay Area. We know what's happened with First Republic Bank. The question was, is this the beginning of the bank crisis? But in the second half of the program, the question comes from a listener that says, should I own only ESG funds? We've got that question's going to come with Drew Drutson. And Steve Anderson is going to give us his economic update, which I'm excited about. Just kind of go through that whole process. What's the update in the market? We're going to talk about a lot of subjects with Steve. So all three of these guys are in the studio with me. We're going to give them a chance to just go through and share what you need to know that's happening right now, what's happening in the market. So let's start with you, Scott, because the question, First Republic Bank of San Francisco run on its deposits of 40%. You've got 11 big banks that have put in a lot of, I can't remember exactly how much it was, but a lot of money has been put in that, $30 billion, I think. I may be off a little bit on that number.
I believe that's correct.
That's a lot of money. I mean, but they're just simply saying they don't want to help this crisis of a run on banks. What's your take?
Well, you know, if you go back to early March where we saw the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank due to their duration mismatch on their assets, that kind of faded quickly. And I think the latest earnings reports and news about First Republic has kind of heightened that concern again. I hear the word banking crisis thrown around a lot. I don't really know that we're at crisis level yet, but that makes a good headline. But I do say that, you know, the issues with First Republic just highlights that during a rate hiking cycle like this, problems can occur. Now, I do give the Fed great credit for stepping in quickly, creating the bank term lending program or the bank term funding program that allows banks that liquidity that they need during these stressful times. They also made depositors whole at Silicon Valley Bank. So they jumped in real quickly to kind of, you know, abate the crisis and stop the contagion. So I do give them credit for that. But we have seen, you know, if you look at data, you see that banks are losing deposits to more higher yielding opportunities out there. So that is something that we continue to observe and watch and pay attention to. And I think the big question on everybody's mind is with the bank issues going on, what does that do to credit? Because credit kind of fuels the economy. And are we going to see a tightening of credit? And I would say, yes, we've already seen that. And I think that, you know, with heightened regulation, maybe heightened reserve requirements on the regional banks, we could see a further tightening of credit. And then you start to hear that word credit crunch thrown around. And that historically has been the cause of several recessions. So I think it's right to look at this and be a little concerned. I would add, though, that, you know, going back to the Fed's response, they do have the ability in today's world to create facilities very quickly. You know, they threw that bank term funding program up within about 24 hours. So I would look to the Fed that as if we do see crisis in different parts of the market, because these things always appear in rate hiking cycles, that I would expect them to jump in very quickly and try to solve that problem.
Well, you know, when you say that, I mean, face it, the consequences, and you mentioned, the bottom line is tightening lending standards and, yes, you know, the falling credit demand.
Right.
Those are two consequences of what the Fed's been doing, and we still got a 25 basis point rate hike, probably. Everybody expects it.
It's anticipated.
In May, so what about the idea when you think about this, and guys, all of you weigh into this, I mean, the whole thought process, do we see issues with maybe not going in and maybe not, you know, where they talked about the whole idea of start reducing rates in the fall? But before we talk about that, I mean, any ideas, guys, that you want to, I mean, as far as this banking crisis, Steve?
Yeah, well, you know, Scott, you mentioned it. There's this issue that, you know, we've talked about Silicon Valley Bank in a previous show, and now we're talking about First Republic, and, you know, every time you talk about another one, it raises fears. But there seem to be some unique things that are going on with each of these banks, but then there's the common thing. So according to Bankrate.com, the average money market fund, all right, not at a bank, but in like an investment account in a money market, we call it like a souped up cash fund, essentially.
I got you.
You put money in there, and the average rate, according to Bankrate right now, is about 4%. The average savings account is still somewhere around a measly 0.2%. So Wall Street Journal reported on the 24th of April, after First Republic reported their quarterly earnings, they lost $100 billion of deposits.
Wow.
Now, you know, there's something to be said about going from 0.2 to 4. That's what smart people do with their cash. So that is a common issue that banks are going to have to face and reconcile. And we're starting to see some banks really expedite the raising of those savings account rates. But that is a common problem that we're going to have to watch, is how do banks retain some level of those deposits?
Well, again, let's go back to the thought between, you know, when I mentioned earlier, tightening down on the lending standard. We see that. In other words, if I could walk in yesterday and have no credit score, I might have been able to get a loan. Today, forget it. They won't even acknowledge that, right? I walked into the store. But the reality is, and then you got this credit demand, a falling credit demand. But you've just mentioned something that we have to all understand. Deposits in a bank is critical, and loans are critical.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, because, I mean, we don't think of it this way, but when we put money in a bank account, technically we're actually loaning money to the bank.
Exactly.
We're loaning it to them, they're paying us interest, and it's on average, according to Bankrate, 0.2%. Pretty killer, right? So they're not paying us much for our money. They're turning around and loaning it out, and now they can loan it out at great rates.
And I think banks kind of got used to what they call sleepy deposits of people that just leave their money there and aren't really paying attention, because when rates, you know, if it's the difference between 0.2 and 0.5, nobody gets that excited about that. But when you're talking about 0.2 versus 4%, now we're talking about some real money.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I think that's why you're seeing people wake up and go, hey, I'm not going to leave my money sitting here for free when I can go out and earn a little better return on it.
So using the word crisis, is that a word maybe a little more media driven, or is it something should we all, I mean, I think it's a legitimate question. Should I be concerned about the crisis?
Well, I hate to diminish. I mean, there are issues out there that are starting to bubble up to the surface.
Talked about them. Yeah.
I think that crisis word is just kind of inflammatory, in my opinion. You know, it just kind of gets everybody thinking, oh, this is a banking crisis. I think when I think of banking crisis, I hearken back to the 2008-2009 great financial crisis.
That's
and
a crisis.
And I don't think right now we're anywhere near that type of situation. Now, it's a fluid situation you have to keep your eye on, but I don't feel like that. You guys may have a different idea.
Drew, what you're thinking?
Well, I mean, I think the question now is, now we know that the banks were definitely behind the eight ball in anticipating the persistence of some of these higher rates. You get the impression from how they've reacted that they thought it would be a short-term blip, and now it's not. And as Steve said, now the smart money is going more toward these higher paying money market funds.
I'm not so sure it's smart money. I think it's just money.
Right.
The reality is, if you're going to offer me 2 basis points or 3 basis points or 0.5% or 1%, or you're going to offer me 4, and I don't have to be smart to do that. I can count. I can. That's, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I got a 10-year-old grandson. I could say, son, you want a 1% or a 4%? He gets that, I think. Yeah.
Well, now instead of a good bank is going to be managed by a race to the bottom on the deposits, and now it's a race to the top, and that whoever is going to win that race. That's going to play out in a lot of different ways with just competition among the banks. But then also that raises its own set of problems down the future of suddenly they're offering interest rates that are too high.
Yeah. Well, and to your question, Jim, exactly what Drew is saying. The way I think I would frame this up is there's a great book called The Black Swan by Nassim Taleb.
I think that's right.
We'll get through it. At any rate, he talks about how when you look out into the world, there are times where like there's nothing that seems risky out there, and the probability of an issue is small. Right now, I think the probability of a full-on bank run taking place nationally, low. probability of a lot of things, though. We talked about before the show, we talked about a little bit about the commercial banking situation, or the mortgage back, the commercial mortgage backed security market. I mean, there's all sorts of things right now that are slightly elevated. And so when you put them all together, the environment is an environment of heightened risk. But it's hard to say which thing, if there's going to be a thing, is going to be the thing,
yeah,
right? Generally speaking, though, we are in a heightened risk environment. No way around that.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. I think that when you think about banks, too, it's not just they're direct lenders to a lot of businesses, individuals, but they also buy a lot of bonds. So they are big purchasers in the bond market, especially in treasuries and things like agency mortgage-backed securities. And they've backed off of that a little bit. So they're in, and what that tells me is they're kind of, you know, taking a wait and see approach and trying to be cautious about maybe needing liquidity in the future. So with them being such a buyer in those markets, if they're not there, that just increases borrowing costs for everybody. So
all right,
something
so
to consider.
I think
too.
You guys have done a great job of saying, okay, we're probably not in a crisis, but Steve, I heard you say we're in a risk environment. So
yeah,
there's a
yeah.
lot of things going on. So what does our listener need to understand when we say that? Because as you come across and that becomes a part of the conversation, I can see every one of us thinking, well, if my money's in the bank, I need to get it out and put it over here in the can and put it in the backyard. And that's not what you need to do. I mean, that really restricts a lot of things. Or I need to pay off my home and, you know, make sure I have. And all those things are things that, yes, we talk about and we plan, but what is it that the listener, the smart money, the guy that's just saying lazy sometimes, maybe not, how do we address this for those individuals?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and the answer is not always that palatable. But
it's not always the same
yeah,
for everybody.
And my opinion is it's a little bit like thinking about skiing. Skiing is always out of control. Sometimes more than others, but you're always sliding. I mean, that's what it is. You're always sliding,
speak
right?
Speak for yourself. I mean, 100%. I never mind.
No, yeah. So the thing right now is
is that water skiing or snow skiing?
Well, I was really thinking snow skiing. Yeah, yeah, I guess you. Both. But yeah.
Racing
anyway,
toward a dead stop.
Towards yeah, that's right. And so the issue really is that it seems more dangerous now because we just hear more stuff.
That's right.
I don't know that it's, I mean, we're in a heightened risk environment, but how much more heightened? I don't know. To me, when you don't know what to do, more times than not, the best thing to do is probably basically nothing.
Nothing. You know, this comment we've always heard, this time is different.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The reality is, you know, we've been through this before. You mentioned the debt crisis, and really that of 07, 08, that was a different crisis completely than what but we use the same word sometimes to describe it. And that's sometimes just that heightened mindset. So I like what you said. Sometimes when you really fear that you've got fear, it's best to take that emotion out and do nothing. Just let the managers manage what you've got managed.
That's right.
And stay the course and don't get caught trying to fix a problem that may not be a problem. Does that make sense, everybody?
Yeah, I think
well,
that's
hey, and to that end, when the market is the most volatile
is when you
right last year the market had 100 according to JP Morgan Chase, the market last year had 122 days that the market moved more than 1%. There's only like 270 some odd trading days in the year. That was the third most volatile year since 1980. But so here's the thing. When the market's that volatile, you have an incredibly great chance of getting out at the wrong time and getting back in at the wrong time. The best time, if you're going to play this game of getting out of the market, you just do it in a dead market. This is not right. a dead market. Nothing is most likely the best thing.
And we want to talk more about that. But, you know, I think we talk about the cycles, and you're kind of mentioning that, and the dead. The reality is we have this volatility that we're talking about. We get into a bear market, and that's where we are. And then we have to end up in some point form of a recession. We talked about that. We've got all kind of, you know, we had this last week, the labor market, I mean, indicated that jobless claims was rose again. So we're seeing the little cracks in the whole idea of the economy. But it's just the way we have to remind everybody, stocks bottom before the end of a recession. We're not there yet. Or we may be. Maybe we're in a recession. Maybe we're not. But the reality is, some point in time, we're going to hit that cycle mindset of the bottoming. And then at that point, what? then we see something taken over. We see the, you know, the bull market take over, but it's we never usually have the market to bottom before a recession. And I think that's what we're seeing right now.
The market is a leading indicator.
Yeah, that's a great point. Great subject. Great. I hope we've answered the question. Steve, let me dive into this. We kind of got into it a little bit, but what would you say is in the kind of the whole idea of the front of mind when you talk about investors right now? We kind of led with this question because I think it was part of it. But what else are you seeing as far as understanding what you're hearing from clients and people you're talking about? I mean, just walking in a while ago, one of the producers here at the station asked me, said, hey, I'm thinking about paying off my loan. I'm thinking about all the things that we got into. You could just tell it's on their mind.
Yeah, well, certainly front of mind, it seems like, is fear of recession. Yeah. Are we going into a recession? And we can talk about that, but before we dive into whether or not we think we're going into a recession, because we actually may all have slightly different opinions, I don't know. But the issue isn't whether or not we're going into a recession, really. We just talked about the market is a leading indicator. Last year, the market dropped almost 20%. So last year, the market was anticipating that this year there might be a recession. So whether or not we actually have technically a recession is not the issue. The real issue we're worried about is, does the economy just collapse? I mean, is growth going to just completely stall? Are we just going to have an unemployment rate that goes through the roof? To me, looking at all the data, and we can talk about some of that in a second, but looking at the data, I find it hard to make a good data-supported argument that things are like deathly terrible and that we should all just be scared. Maybe we have a technical recession, but most experts that are using data and not making political points are kind of making the point we're slowed our growth a little bit, but it's not that bad.
Yeah, slowing down is not as bad as a crisis. And I think what you're saying is, and I think so many people get caught up in back to the emotions that we talk about a lot. We let that kind of drive us. But the reality is, the leading indicator, the indicators, yeah, they're showing some cracks, but that's kind of normal. That's what we've been expecting.
That's what we're trying to do.
That's what we're trying. We're trying to kill inflation. Yeah. So if you know we're trying to take, you know, you have a choice, recession or inflation. Inflation long term is not a good thing. So the Fed has got to raise the rates. We just raised rates historically last year more times than we've done in the last 50 years. So what we're seeing are some of these things are really coming out consequences of what we've done. We're going to raise it again, probably in May. Why are we not anticipating some of the outcomes of doing that, and yet it's still showing us signs, as you said, the economy's clicking along pretty strong. Unemployment is still not an issue, but we're seeing lending slow down. We're seeing some credit shifts, and these are kind of parts of what we should be anticipating, and that's important.
Yeah, and I would agree with Steve. The issue is not so much whether we're going into a small...
What about me?
We're breaking ground here.
Yeah, I agree with Steve. What about me?
Mark it on the calendar. I always agree with you, Jim.
Let's start this comment over. No, go ahead, Drew.
No, I think Steve's right. The issue is not so much whether we're going into a technical recession or not. The issue is the sky really falling? And if you look at the two biggest recessions in living memory, the first one being the Great Depression, next being the Great Recession, what were those two? I mean, the Great Depression was essentially a deflationary depression. If you think that goods and services are going to be cheaper tomorrow than they are today, you're going to wait till tomorrow to buy anything. And the next day, you're going to do the same thing, and then the same thing, and then the same thing. And that's how you get a real bad economic downturn like we had in the 30s. Well, if you look at the amount of liquidity that's been pumped into the system over the last 3 years, that just seems very, very unlikely. Then if you look at the Great Recession of 07 to 09, that essentially started out as a housing crisis, where then you had a housing glut, so to speak, and then prices followed from too much supply. That's not the case today at all. Now we're in a pretty severe housing shortage just based on needs. So the idea that this is going to 2008 repeating itself also seems low. So both of those two just seem very, very unlikely to me.
Well, I think what you're doing is taking data that what Steve was talking about and Scott and all of us have been talking about and putting it together and saying, hey guys, the data doesn't tell us it's the crisis of the Great Depression or it's the 07, 08 financial crisis. But we're going to go through some type of a cycle here. We just need to be prepared for that. If you just tuned in, of course, I'm talking with three heavyweights here. Got Scott Jordan, Drew Johnson, and Steve Anderson. We're talking about, you know, your questions. We talked about Republic Bank and that 40% loss of deposits in the first quarter. We kind of walked you through that. We've been talking about what we're seeing as the economy and helping you understand it's serious, but it's not that serious. It's important for us to understand it, and we want you to be sure. Coming up in the second half, we're going to continue with Steve, talk some more about some things about literally what are we seeing that we need to be sensitive to, and what do we want to share with you, how you prepare for it. Also, Drew Johnson's going to dive into ESG. What is the meaning of ESG? Environmental, social, and governance. And should that be a part of your overall portfolio, and how much? Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Jim Shoemaker. This is Talk Money.
Certain strategies with an emphasis on environmental, social, and governance, ESG factors, take into account non-financial objectives and limit the investment opportunities available to an investor. ESG investments may underperform or perform differently than strategies that do not have an ESG focus. An ESG focus may result in investing in securities or industry sectors that maintain a different risk profile than the market generally, or different risk profile when compared to strategies that are not screened for ESG standards.
Helping you make the most of your money. Talk Money with Jim Shoemaker on News Talk 98.9.
This material represents an assessment of the market environment at a specific point in time and is not intended to be a forecast of future events or a guarantee of future results. This information is not investment advice or recommendation. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Investments will fluctuate and when redeemed may be worth more or less than when originally invested.
Helping you make the most of your money. It's time for Talk Money. Now, your host, Jim Shoemaker.
Welcome back. I'm Jim Shoemaker. You're listening, of course, to Talk Money. My guest is Steve Anderson, Drew Johnson, and Scott Jordan. Currently, we're talking about the economy and what do we see from what's the update in the market. Steve Anderson's going through that process. And Steve, I just want to ask you, when you begin to figure out this thought process, and all of you weigh in on this because all you guys do this, but Steve, you particularly, what data are you seeing that's kind of informing you to form an opinion? You talked about a little bit of the risk and what it's all about, but I don't see the word crisis in your language.
Yeah, you can have an opinion, and I'm sure you can find a piece of data to support it.
I mean, I'm sure you can.
Yeah, we can all do that.
By the way, all three of you could do that. Right. I know that. And by the way, it'd be three different opinions, but that's why you're on the program, guys.
Well, and to that end, I mean, a few of the things that we'll look at. So, for one of them, for instance, GDP. So, most of these data points, too. The thing I want to stress is context. All right. So, GDP was growing at like 6% coming out of COVID. All right, GDP is just a measure of how productive is an economy. Our economy for like the last 40 years has averaged 2%. So 6 was never sustainable. All right, and the reason it was 6 is because we shut the economy down and it grew from 0 at 6% a year. Okay, now it's growing. The first quarter was revised up to 3.3%. I mean, come on, that's still way above the average. Yes, it's half of what we were doing, but it's still really good.
And it's, I mean, we don't hear the... That's good.
That's
we
a
hear
good thing.
It's half of what it was.
That's right. And then, like, you'll hear people, oh, credit card delinquencies are going up. And that is absolutely right. They are going up. And, you know, they were at all-time lows, at least going back to the Depression, yeah. All-time lows. So now they're still below average, but yes, they're going up. And you look at the percentage of a household income that's servicing debt going up. Well, it's obviously going up because interest rates are going up. But still, since 1980, never been lower. All these different data points. You look at jobs. Okay, layoffs are up. Yes, they're up from all-time lows. You can look at JOLTS, which is my favorite indicator, because a JOLT is who's quitting a job. And the only reason you quit a job is because the grass is greener on the other side. JOLTS, quits are up. But they're down, right? So they're coming down, which means people are starting to fear. Where they're coming down off all-time highs, still the highest since 1980. So all this data, it's about context. Things are weakening, which is the point of the interest rate hikes. But it's not like the end of the world is like upon us.
But why is it, and Scott, I know you have an opinion on this too, so all of you do, but the reality is, why is it that the media hits us between the eyes with all the crisis? I mean, that's just, I mean, you just literally laid it out, Steve, in such a way to put it in perspective. And yet, we don't see that coming at us a lot of times from the media.
Well, Jim, if the media came out and said, everything's really fine, you're okay, go back to living life, have a good time, that doesn't really sell too well. You know, fear sells, they want you coming back, so... and this is not to knock on media, really. It's just kind of a fact of life that the more alarming headlines get your attention, and that's really what they want. And again, this is not to say that everything's rosy and everything's perfect. Steve had highlighted earlier that, yes, there are some risks in the system, but I think what we're seeing is that slowing momentum that Steve described and not falling off a cliff for the economy or earnings or anything else at this point in time, so...
All right, well, so let's put it, see if I can kind of summarize the conversation, because, Steve, I really want you to say, okay, with all that we've talked about and all the noise, you know, what are we recommending for people to do? What are we helping them understand? And we'll get into ESG in a minute, but the reality is, with all that noise, generally, what are you saying to people that they need to be doing? But keep in mind, let's summarize. A lot of news, we got a lot of risks, but yet it's not as bad. And it you have to be able to assimilate all of that and then come out with your own decision. And for a lot of people, that's very difficult, because we only hear negative, 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 yeah, over and over and over again. And we sometimes, I think we do, and I have talked to people that do, freeze.
Yeah.
And that's back to your comment earlier. Don't, you know, by doing nothing sometimes, that is the best thing to do. And this terminate, this word, just get a, this time it's different. That's just not the case.
Yeah, so the action items that we have been most commonly discussing with clients are A, do nothing, and B, a derivation of do nothing is, if we're just inclined to do something, the simple thing to do is just think. Last year was a pretty volatile year as a whole. Stock market down about 20%, bond market down about 13%, tough year. So if we're inclined to do something, the simple thing to do is just a simple rebalance, meaning get everything back to the original weight it was supposed to be, because last year there were some real winners and losers by comparison. That's what happens in a time of volatility. And we've already seen the rotation from last year's winners being this year's laggards. So it's a good time to rebalance, but that's not a major thing. That's a simple move. You typically do that once, twice a year anyways. That's about the extent of what we're doing at this point.
You know, Drew, you talk about this a lot, letting the managers, because at the office, you're in charge of basically reviewing all of our managers and watching what they're doing. Why is it important to let the managers, sometimes they're rebalancing their portfolios, but we're rebalancing our own. But why is it so important to let the managers do their job?
Well, I mean, the most important reason is that the managers are already ahead of us. The managers are ahead of us as a firm. They're ahead of the consumers. They're ahead of their own investors. They're thinking ahead, looking ahead to the next 3 years, 5 years, in some cases even longer.
They're not short-term investors, is what you're saying.
They're not. They're looking at what's going to be profitable over the next cycle and how do we position accordingly based on the assets that we have today. And they don't disclose that right away. You can't look at the assets of a particular investment fund and be able to tell what are they in today. You don't know. They're not going to disclose
that
right
away. Not if you're looking at that. We can talk to them. I mean, I know you talk to them and you kind of get some ideas, because you mentioned at one point in time that what you like about a manager is it's not that they're reacting to the media. They've got something, as you said, planned out. And it's when things happen in the economy, they can execute.
I think I mentioned in a previous show that what we want to look for in a manager, how to tell a good one from a bad one, is, does that manager have a shopping list? Is there something that they're already looking to buy, regardless of what else is going on, and they're waiting for that particular item or company, as it were, to go on sale for them? And then, is it a good opportunity for them? That's what we're really looking for. And so an individual investor who's dealing with a plethora of different mutual funds or ETFs in their portfolio, they can't make that decision, but the manager can. and they likely already have.
And I would, kind of echoing on that, I would just say, which really we're all saying the same thing, is that, you know, the economy can't be consistently predicted or forecast. The market is very difficult to time. So the only way of being assured of hitting that long-term goal objective or the long-term returns of the market is to stay invested and ride out the temporary volatility or temporary downturns. That has been the most successful strategy of long-term investors for a long time. So it's sticking with those guiding principles. I like what Steve said about rebalance. I have that asset allocation set up ahead of time. I'm going to stay diversified. And if I have to do anything, let's just rebalance the portfolio to stick with our long-term goal objective.
You know, if I listen to us on a regular basis, and we have some people that listen to us on a regular basis, we kind of hammer that pretty hard.
It's
fundamental.
It is. We sound like a broken record, but it's what works long-term. It is what allows you to be a successful investor long-term.
And, of course, we always say this because, bottom line, whether it's rebalancing or asset allocation or diversification, they do not guarantee against the loss. And we understand that. But they're methods of managing risk. And Steve, you really clearly said, okay, there's risk. But that doesn't mean you stop investing because the word risk or the word volatility. Last year was, on record, a very volatile year. But you know what? We see what's happening now. And you can back to the whole idea. You stay with it. You stay with it for the long term. And, Scott, you do this so well. You know what your why is. And this is so critical. What are you investing for? What's your long-term objective? And I think that's kind of what I want to make sure that our listeners gather up. You've done a great job of putting that together. Guys, I do want to shift to a question. ESG, should I own ESG stocks? And, you know, that we see mutual funds now doing a lot of that. There's some companies that have really kind of stuck their flag in the ground and said, we're ESG 100%. So, Drew, both you, all three of you, let's just talk about what is ESG, what's the meaning of ESG, and what do you see going on in the future when we talk about ESG investing? Drew, let's start with you.
Well, I think if we wind back the clock, say 3 to 5 years, and we're talking about ESG, you mentioned and people go, what is that? And you can pretty much sum it up with the idea of a socially responsible investment, one that's trying to make a good impact on the community and on its stakeholders and so forth. But as they often say, the devil is in the details. So 5 years ago, we were saying, what is it? That was the question. Today, it's should we or shouldn't we?
Okay, but now, when you mention ESG, okay, it's environmental, social, and government. Governance, there were some things back 5, 6, 7, 10 years ago when that sounded good.
They did.
Sounded very altruistic.
Well, and so now that the question is should we or shouldn't we, and what I'm referencing there is now you have different states that are wanting to adopt different rules about how much influence ESG criteria should really have on different types of investment plans that are governed by that state's rules. The problem is the original question, what is it, was never really answered satisfactorily. And so now that's kind of starting to filter down into popular perceptions. People, I think, are starting to get it. We were talking earlier amongst ourselves that it was not that long ago, the last nuclear plant in California was scheduled to be shuttered and was saved at almost literally the last minute, in part because where is the power going to come from now that this plant was providing? But also, this is actually more environmentally friendly than the alternative. And then kind of on the opposite side of that, I think it was last week or the week before, Germany, as part of a long-term plan that they adopted following the Fukushima disaster in Japan, Germany did shutter its last operational nuclear plant a week or two ago over the objections of various environmental groups. So when you're looking at ESG, E being the environmental and S being the social, you have the S part saying you should go away from nuclear and toward wind and solar, but you have the E saying you should go more nuclear. and so the question remains, is this actually a coherent program to start out with? And if it's not, we may not even be talking about ESG in 5 or 10 years now. There'll be a different nomenclature for it entirely with a different set of criteria that are being applied to it. So it still remains very much an open question, just like it was 5 years ago. What are we really talking about to start off with? And until we get that resolved, the should we or should we is going to generate a bunch of different incoherent answers.
You're making my head spin, man.
Yeah. Well, and to that end, Scott said when we were talking about the economy that know your why. So as an investor, you have to answer the question for yourself. Okay. Is the point of my investing, you know, I'm putting money in my 401k or my account or whatever, is the point of my investing I'm trying to maximize my returns? Or have you made it a position in your mind that I want to maximize my impact? Because a lot of ESG investing is really related to, you know, you're funding in a way when you're investing, you're voting about where money flows and into what areas of the economy money is flowing. And so if the point is I want to have compound returns, then that leads to one outcome. If the point is I want to make an impact with my money while hopefully compounding my returns, then that lends itself a little more to ESG. So it goes back to what Scott said. Why?
And I think that this is where I always tell people when they bring it up, because the media has certainly hammered this recently, and I think the ESG has kind of been hijacked by this idea that, you know, I like what you said, impact, because that is generally when you look back, because there's funds that have been doing this for decades. This is not anything new. And I think the idea as an investor, I want to put my money somewhere where it has the impact that I want it to have is really a good thing. I think where it's been hijacked is the high profile stories where somebody has taken that influence and kind of commandeered it and centralized it, and they're using that influence for their ideological purposes, and that's where we saw it.
But guys, wait a second. You guys, I mean, you know, Tyler's over here, our producer, and y'all, I mean, we're talking such, I mean, you're going back and forth. Tyler, you said that makes your head spin.
Well, I like hearing the detailed, nuanced versions of these. Steve said the most important words in this whole podcast.
Don't go to Steve. Oh,
Steve's winning.
I'm finished. The most important words, which you're all contributing to, and Steve just happened to say, are in context. And I think that helps everybody when you get to hear this kind of crosstalk where, 10 years ago or whatever it was, Drew, they come up with this acronym that they think looks good as a slogan, but doesn't actually accomplish either A, the explanation, or B, a sensible collection of action items.
There you go.
Well, I think part of what's going to help us come to some resolution as to what is it is to go back to what is it supposed to do. And the idea behind ESG is not to, you know, be all, you know, flowers and feel good Pollyannish. The idea behind ESG is that it is supposed to help maximize profit. The idea behind having a diverse corporate board is that you're unleashing talent and you're allowing more potential to have an impact where it needs to be felt. And if you are reducing waste and you're reducing externalities, that should increase the profitability of a company. That's the whole idea.
Yeah.
And so that's what it's after. It is ultimately about maximizing profit by taking more things into account than been taken into account previously. And so ESG cannot become, I want to maximize profit for everyone else. It has to be, I want to maximize profit for myself and for all the other players involved. It cannot be a zero-sum game between me, the investor, and all the other stakeholders. And if it becomes that, then the whole project will fall apart. And I think that would be a bad thing based on what it was intended to accomplish.
Yeah, and to exactly what Scott said previously, it gets hijacked because, I mean, we want to unleash talent on corporate boards. Nobody's going to argue against that, right? We don't want the environment to just roll over and die. Nobody wants that. What happens is this whole topic gets hijacked, and it's like, hey, we need to have X number of this on the board and X number of this on the board, and we're going to mandate this.
Right.
And the problem is when you try to take a moral thing and make it a law thing, that doesn't work real well. You can't enforce morality or you can't enforce ideology very well through legal standards. And so that's what we keep bumping up against with this is how do we encourage the diversification in boards and some of these ideas without making this like a mandate that everybody, like certain people are always going to get mad about a rule.
That's a great point. If you just tuned in, obviously, this is kind of a subject that we're debating it. We're just discussing it and hoping we're clearing up some of the questions you have, because it came in as a question, what is and should I invest in ESG? And those are questions, and we don't want your head spinning. Tyler helped us with that. But it's easy because it is a big subject and a lot of the big problems. We've got Scott Jordan, Drew Johnson, and Steve Anderson. I could do it if I do it in the line, but if I got to jump around, guys, it's tough for me. But these guys are doing a great job of this. Now, let me kind of summarize something here. We've covered a lot of subjects, but what are the disadvantages? I mean, you know, what can I, can, for our investor, for our listener, Drew, dive in to tell me, what do you see? I mean, right now there's no governance to it. I mean, we talk about governance, but as far as we're concerned, the SEC hasn't weighed in. FINRA hasn't weighed in. So what's your take on what's some of the disadvantages?
Well, I mean, there is a big potential risk of just the dislocation of capital and large amounts of money simply being misallocated. If you have investment vehicles that say they're ESG, well, the problem with that is, what if at some point that becomes the subject of real legislation, you know, whether at the state or the federal level? Well, suddenly the reason to exist for those investments has gone away, because now every investment has to meet those criteria. So you, the small investor, could end up losing money going into that strategy because it simply anticipated something that society as a whole was already going to do.
And
that's a risk.
Yeah, we've seen that in the past with tax legislation, where the government is going in and change taxes, then that changed that investment.
I think it comes down to, you know, there's no objective ESG criteria, and then the question becomes, okay, who gets to establish that objective criteria, and what agendas are we pushing through that? So I think that's one of the things I see as a potential risk to it. Going back to, I think the seeds of ESG are actually good. I always say that. We all want to kind of promote that human flourishing and put our money in companies that are doing good things for society. But I think the danger becomes when that gets mandated, as Steve says, and all of a sudden we're having to check these boxes just to align with this ESG criteria, that can put unnecessary regulatory burden on businesses, increased cost and things like that. So I see that as some of the potential dangers of it.
That's a good point. Now, Drew, I want to make sure that I understand this. When you say things could change, are you talking about subsidies? I mean, if all of a sudden windmills, let's just say I get a subsidy to build windmills and I'm a manufacturer of windmills, and I meet all the criteria being ESG, but all of a sudden the subsidies, government subsidies, go away, that may change that whole company. It may go out of business as a result of that.
Yeah, the subsidies may go away, the tax credits may go away, and then also there's always the risk of the job being finished. I mean, when you look at the internet boom, and especially, you know, look at the growth of smartphones, you know, right after the 08 financial crisis. Well, that would not have been possible without all of the fiber optic hardware that had been laid down in the first decade of this century. And so investing in companies that were laying down that hardware would have been really profitable during a short period of time. But at some point, the work is done. So then what happens when everybody's driving electric cars? Well, then what do you do? Well, now the profit goes more into other. It could be big data. It could be anything. But that's the danger there, is you end up thinking that because this is growing the way that it is now, that it's going to keep going on forever. And that's,
you kind of laid it out for us. You know, what's it going to look like in 5 years? And ESG could be a problem.
Yeah, and just funny comment. You made a comment about the issue of one area of ESG messing with the other. I mean, the whole push around going to battery technology. You know, we're all for, like, figuring out how to mine more lithium. But in order to mine more lithium, you basically blow the economy, or you blow nature up to make it happen, right? So there's this weird issue that we have to, you know, it's a sticky subject.
And the same thing, if you look deeply into the solar panel supply chains, there's definitely some issues with that too. So
that's a
very popular one. Yeah, exactly. I'm talking really about the labor issues and some of the other things. So you really have to look deep into this, and that goes back to that really no objective criteria. It's kind of organizations picking winners or losers based
on
their own. Yep.
Well, guys, you did a great job. I want to thank my guests, Steve Anderson, Drew Johnson, and Scott Jordan. If you got questions for these guys, please give them a call, 901-757-7255. 5757. You can find our show, Talk Money, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Search for Talk Money with Jim Shoemaker. Subscribe to the podcast. We'd appreciate it. And I'm reminding you that you can always ask questions. Just simply type them to Jim, J-I-M, to the text line. That's 901-683-0989. Or you can send it to talkmoney@shoemakerfinancial.com. Next week, we've got Shannon Dyson's going to be with us. Strategies on controlling employer health care costs. Man, I tell you, big subject. Rob Clement's going to talk about exposure for scams that are for tips for elders. Don't want to miss that. And, of course, Daniel Irwin from the Better Business Bureau is here for the first week of every month, and he's going to take us to scam school. That's Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. and Sunday at 9 a.m. I want to thank my producer, Titus Springs and Maximilian, guest and content coordination, Francis Fortner, production and marketing assistant, Laura Norsworthy, and compliance officer, Tommy Armstrong. Thank you so much for listening. We're here every week helping you make the most of your money. I'm Jim Shoemaker. This is Talk Money.
Jim Shoemaker, Steve Anderson, Drew Johnson, and Scott Jordan are registered representatives and investment advisor representatives of Securian Financial Services, Inc., securities dealer, member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor. Shoemaker Financial is independently owned and operated.
Helping you make the most of your money. This has been Talk Money with Jim Shoemaker on News Talk 98.9.